Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The six states reporting anywhere from one-fifth to one-third of the corn crop rated very poor to poor. We have Missouri at 35%, Kansas 33%, Minnesota and Texas at 24%, Nebraska 25%, and Wisconsin at 20%.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA, taking a look at the latest corn condition ratings and also looks at maturation.
We have a couple of states that saw a 20 percentage point change in maturity from the previous week, and that's where the hot, dry weather built in late in the week. In the Dakotas, we saw a big jump in maturity in North Dakota from 51 to 73% during the week ending October 1st. And in South Dakota, big jump from 60 to 80%.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index fell 9 points compared to last month. That leaves the index 6 points below a year earlier and 18 points below 2 years ago.
Director for the Center for Commercial Agriculture, Dr. Jim Mentor.
The decline in the barometer was driven by declines in both the Current Conditions Index and the Future Expectations Index. Both of those indices fell 10 points compared to a month earlier. That left the current condition index 10% lower than in September of last year, and left the future expectation index 3% lower than it was in September of 2022. The Farm Financial Performance Index was unchanged compared to August, but the index was down 13 points compared to a year ago, and that left the index 24 points below where it was 2 years ago. We continue to ask producers what their biggest concerns are for the upcoming year, and high input cost remains the top concern among producers. But that's followed closely by the concerns about rising interest rates and lower crop and/or livestock prices. The Farm Capital Investment Index was up 2 points compared to last month, and that left it 8 points higher than it was a year ago at this time. We followed up with those who said it is a bad time to make large farm investments, and 40% of them said it was because of the impact of rising interest rates. Farmers remain cautiously optimistic about farmland values. The short-term farmland index was unchanged from August, but that left that index 3 points higher than a year ago. And the long-term index, which looks at the five-year outlook for farmland values, was up 2 points compared to August, and actually up 14 points compared to a year ago. This month's survey included several questions about farmers' use of cover crops in their farming operation. The questions were targeted at corn and soybean growers, and 52% of those corn and soybean growers said they plant cover crops, but nearly half of them said they do it on 25% or less of their farm's acreage.
Another area of concern, for the most part, for producers, the end of combustible engines. Nick Langworthy is a representative from New York.
We'll put to a full stop my own state of New York from banning affordable, reliable gas-powered vehicles. Now, last year, Governor Kathy Hochul announced that New York State, not to be outdone by Democrats in California, would move forward with a ban on the sale of new gas-powered vehicles by 2035. Mr. Speaker, this asinine approach is only the latest in a long list of actions taken by the Biden administration and by Democrats in my own state to foist new bans, regulations, and costs onto the backs of hardworking middle-class Americans. My colleagues on the other side of the aisle, they want the American people to believe that ditching our internal combustion engines for battery-powered cars, that's a silver bullet to a greener, cleaner future. But my constituents in upstate New York, in rural upstate New York, are facing energy costs that are 30% higher than previous years. And those costs are projected only to increase further and further. Rural towns and communities in western New York and the southern tier along the Pennsylvania border, they cannot survive on transportation that is solely battery powered, given the long distances driven, charger accessibility, and lack of reliability that comes with the current crop of EVs. Now, last week, President Biden's own energy secretary, Granholm, she put on a master's class on the issues rural Americans will face, from failing to find working charging stations to long wait times. Her EV road trip was a total disaster. It was like an episode of Veep, and we cannot make this a reality for everyday Americans.
Of course, that was part of a debate before the debt ceiling, a continuing resolution, and the firing of the Speaker of the House. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The USDA September Hogs and Pigs Report places the September 1st inventory of all hogs and pigs at 74.3 million head, up just more than 2% from last quarter and about a quarter of a percent from last year.
Dr. Jason Franken with Western Illinois University.
An ever so slight surprise given pre-report estimates that it was essentially unchanged to nearly 2% lower. Much of the surprise reflects market hogs, which the USDA pegs at about 0.4% higher compared to trade expectations, again ranging from unchanged to nearly 2% lower, as they both agreed on a roughly 1% smaller breeding herd. All weight classes of market hog inventories come in a bit above average pre-report expectations, with the lighter classes accounting for most of the unanticipated market hogs. Only the under 50-pound class lands above the anticipated range, up slightly from last year and about 1.5% more than the average pre-report estimate. All other weight classes are within pre-report expected ranges. Overall, compared to a year ago, there's almost 0.5% more hogs weighing under 180 pounds, which will be the market hogs arriving at processing plants from October 2023 through February 2024. The modest increase in lighter weight class hogs partly reflects that the June to August pig crop is also just less than 0.5% larger than last year compared to expectations ranging from 0.8% to 2.1% lower, with about 3.7% fewer sows farrowed that was more than offset by a record 11.61 pigs saved per litter, or 4.3% more than were saved in the same period last year. Hence, onward marches the ever-upward trend in pigs per litter. The barely larger pig crop should lead to a marginally larger slaughter this winter. Farrowing intentions for the fall and winter respectively are down 5.2% and 1.4% from the prior year, which along with trend pigs per litter suggests lower spring and potentially higher summer slaughter levels than a year ago. Cold stocks of pork have rebounded and even resumed seasonal patterns, though still have not returned to average pre-COVID pandemic levels. According to the USDA's cold storage report, cold stocks of pork on August 31st are up about 0.1% from the previous month, but down nearly 13% from a year ago. Beef stocks are up 3% from last month, but down 18% from a year ago, while poultry stocks are down 0.25% from last month, but up 1% from a year ago. In light of tight supplies, domestic inflationary pressures, and export demand, the USDA has revised forecasts of U.S. per capita pork consumption downward to 49.8 pounds per person in 2023 and again in 2024, which is the lowest it's been since 2015. The U.S. exported 505 million pounds of pork in July, or about 4% more than in July of 2022. Much of the growth reflects greater exports to Canada and Mexico, while declines occurred in major Asian markets like South Korea, Japan, and China and Hong Kong. Accordingly, the USDA lowered prior estimates for U.S. pork exports to 1.6 and 1.8 billion pounds, respectively, in the third and fourth quarters of 2023, which are still 2.4% and 7.1% above a year ago, raising annual exports by 7.2% over last year. Annual pork exports are forecast to rise 1.5% to 6.9 billion pounds in 2024. Taking all this into account, prices over the next four quarters seem unlikely to exceed current cost of production around $99 a hundredweight. The forecast presented here is for the national weighted average net price on a carcass basis for all transactions for producer sold barrows and gilts, including negotiated and contract prices. This net price should be more reflective of what producers receive on average and often averages a premium of more than $2 a hundredweight over the base price, and for the period from July through September averaged $96.23 a hundredweight compared to $92.53 a hundredweight for corresponding net prices for negotiated or spot transactions.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Well, realistically, the patriarch and matriarch of that family farm or ranch operation really need to identify what are your goals and objectives.
Talking about succession planning, Brandon Dirkschneider, President, Insurance Design Management of Omaha.
Because one of the things that we always talk about, and it's, you know, it's the gold rule, and it's really not the one that you learn in church, is you as the gold gets to make the rules. So the patriarch and matriarch of that farm or ranch operation, they have to be on the same page. And if they're not on the same page, it's really difficult to get that plan off of first base. And it's really difficult to make sure that that plan can actually succeed. So we really need to take some time establishing what are mom and dad's goals and objectives. Can they be financially independent away from that family farm or ranch operation? Because they're probably not going to want to give up control if they're not financially independent. So what does that financial independence or cash flow look like for mom and dad if they want to start transitioning ownership or giving up control? What family should be involved in the process? What family members should be at the family meetings? Who should have a voice? And how should that communication take place is very important when we talk about farm succession planning. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about identifying successors. Who are the successors of the operation? And are those successors capable? Are they capable to lead the farm or ranch operation into the future and grow and enhance the value of that operation? We're going to talk about estate planning. We're going to talk about contingency planning or risk mitigation and what effects that has in succession planning. We'll talk about entity structure and taxes and how tax you do not want to try to have Uncle Sam being a major benefactor with the part of your transition plan. We're going to talk about how you value assets and that business valuation. We'll talk about exit strategies if you don't have the next generation coming back and you're worried about what you're going to do with your family farm or ranch with the next generation not coming back. And then we'll always, as always, you need to implement and follow up. Because realistically, as I tell all of our clients, these plans probably more than likely are going to change every 3 to 5 to 7 years. As I stated earlier, tax laws change, family dynamics change, family members come and go. These plans constantly have to be updated to make sure that they're still accomplishing the same goals and objectives that the patriarch or matriarch of that farm family had set forth.
Are you looking to avoid probate?
You can avoid probate by how you title property. So if you own property jointly with rights of survivorship, so if a husband and wife own a house or a farm or another asset that's titled joint tenants with rights of survivorship, at the death of that first individual, the asset automatically flows to the surviving spouse. You can pass assets by a beneficiary designation. A beneficiary designation actually supersedes what an estate planning document states. So you may say that, you know, you want your children to get your life insurance, death benefits, or you want your children to get your IRAs because maybe your spouse doesn't need them. But if you don't complete your beneficiary designations correctly, it will, whoever you listed as your primary beneficiary, that's who those assets are going to go to, even if your estate planning documents say something different. We have transfer on death deeds or payable on death accounts, which will automatically pass those assets or those accounts to whoever that transfer on death deed names, or you can give it away during your lifetime. And there's nothing wrong with the aspects of giving away gifts during your lifetime if you're financially independent and you don't need those assets. You give those away today, your beneficiaries have complete ownership and the right to use some of those assets. And with some of our farm operators, that may make sense. That next generation may need to be building their net worth. They may need to be building their lending capital or their working capital. So what's the pros and cons of making lifetime gifts?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The administration is also committed to addressing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, and we're open to using every tool available in this effort, including biofuels.
Rod Snyder is Senior Advisor for Agriculture at the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA.
Notably, the Inflation Reduction Act includes biofuels tax credits, funding for blender pump infrastructure, and incentives for sustainable aviation fuel development. And I know many of us in the room are paying attention to the guidance that the Treasury Department is developing right now around the types of feedstocks that will qualify for SAF tax credits. Of course, this is in addition to EPA's important role of administering the renewable fuel standard. Upon arriving at EPA 2 years ago, Administrator Regan made it clear that getting the RFS back on track has been one of his key priorities, and I think we've been delivering on that. The RFS program has played a central role over the past decade in driving the development and use of low-carbon biofuels, but at the time was suffering from COVID-related impacts and several years of mismanagement. So in June, EPA finalized the largest renewable volume obligations in the history of the RFS, which means greater opportunities for farmers to deliver low-carbon biofuels into the future. I want to repeat that. We have finalized the largest renewable volume obligations in the history of the program. With the demand created by the RFS set rule, we project that the new standard will require nearly 7 billion RINs worth of advanced biofuels, including biomass-based diesel, in 2025. That's a nearly 40% increase over the 2022 baseline. And for corn-based ethanol, the final rule sets targets at or above the 15 billion gallon statutory level for all 3 years. That had not been done prior to this administration. The most recent RFS rule was also unprecedented due to the fact that it included volumes for a three-year period rather than a single year, so for 2023, 2024, and 2025. And this was based upon input from stakeholders who have told us that longer-term targets are needed to help the agriculture, biofuels, transportation, and energy sectors plan for the future. The RFS program continues to play an important role in diversifying our nation's energy supply, improving energy independence and security, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions and supporting rural economies. According to our analysis, we estimate that the RFS program increases revenues for farmers by approximately $18 billion every single year. Just last week, Thursday and Friday, EPA's Independent Science Advisory Board, the SAB, met in Washington, D.C., and one of the topics that they took up in terms of a draft commentary was looking at how do we value the greenhouse gas benefits of biofuels, but specifically from corn-based ethanol. I want to start by mentioning that this is an independent science advisory board. So they take up what issues they want to, they take positions that they want to, and then they deliberate those and then report them to the administrator. So this was not something that was initiated at either the career or political staff level. It was done by the SAB themselves. Where I think we sort of appreciate their conversation is that everyone agrees that we need to do a better job of valuing the greenhouse gas benefits of various feedstocks. EPA's Renewable Fuel Standard rulemaking in 2010 was the last time we established those greenhouse gas values for different feedstocks. The world has changed a lot in the last 13 years. Technologies have improved. Farmers have become more efficient. Biofuels facilities are taking on different processing, which has also made it less greenhouse gas intensive. So we are interested in also improving the science around this within the agency. As part of the RFS set rule that was published in June that I mentioned, there was what is called a model comparison exercise that was published at that time that looked at a wide variety of models and studies that looked at greenhouse gas emissions values of different feedstocks. And there's a huge range. So within the technical staff of our agency, we want to narrow that range. We want to have a better understanding and some consensus. That's going to take some time.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm the Iowa guy, so again, we're about a third of pork production, so this is something that I certainly follow intently.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz normally focused on beef cattle, but says it's important to understand competing protein.
We need to keep in mind competition for protein, right? And so when you think about beef prices relative to pork prices, there is a substitution effect there by consumers. And now some research has shown that maybe that substitution effect isn't as large. For example, as beef prices increase relative to pork prices, maybe we don't see as many consumer switch as maybe historically happened. But I'll remind us that we're actually seeing some of the widest spreads ever between beef prices and pork prices. And so there is some sensitivity, I think, to that spread between beef and pork, as well as beef and chicken. So what did the latest report tell us? Well, I think overall it was pretty bearish for the hog market. Pretty much all numbers came in line above pre-report expectations. So market supplies were much larger. That indicates short term we're going to see more pigs come to market, which means more pounds of pork potentially. As well as we looked at the breeding herd, that came in above expectations. And that breeding herd is something we continue to monitor as the pork industry is going through the worst financial times ever. You would suspect that we may see a real contraction in that breeding herd, but we haven't seen those numbers maybe curtailed as many had expected. So that sets up for maybe 2024 being similar to 2023 or even larger production. Again, so implications on pork prices, you know, that could continue to pressure those prices and continue that spread between beef and pork, because given supplies of beef and cattle, we know that those prices will continue to increase for the beef market.
How does productivity factor into the equation?
To me and to many others, it has to be the increase in productivity. So USDA, they provide an estimate of pig saved per litter for the June-August quarter, which would be the latest quarter reported. And that number was up 4.3% compared to year-ago levels. The last two quarters have seen dramatic increases in productivity. I think there's a lot of factors contributing to that. I think we've seen maybe lower disease incidence, which has helped provide increases in productivity, maybe an indication that the labor challenges that we've faced over the last several years are maybe starting to work themselves out a little bit. I think we still really remain tight in our labor supplies. And then I think some of the ongoing culling, maybe culling the older, less productive sows, is contributing to that increase in productivity.
So is this a long-term trend?
So I think as we reviewed last week's trade, I think it's very much a short-term blip. We did see a bit of weakness, especially when we look at fed cattle and feeder cattle trade on the futures market. Again, a bit of a market correction. I think it was some technical factors going on. I think we certainly remain long-term bullish when we look at those contracts. The one thing I'll maybe leave our listeners with, and you may be sick of hearing it, is I think given the values we're at currently in the feeder cattle market as well as the fed cattle market, there's a lot of money at risk, right? And even though we're viewing this as a rather bullish market, you see instances like this where you can see market corrections. And I think that sets the stage for using some form of risk management to really just mitigate against those potential downturns that could be short to medium term. And so we think about all the factors impacting these markets. Certainly a government shutdown could add some turmoil to these markets because of that added uncertainty. This is really a time, I think, just to review that risk management, to understand maybe what is that risk and how much risk that you can bear.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
When you pass away, it's not what you think the asset's worth. It's not what's listed on the assessor's website. You actually have to go get certified appraisers or appraisals done on those assets.
Brandon Dirkschneider, President, Insurance Design Management of Omaha, on determining the value of an estate.
You will file what's called a 706 form. And that 706 form has to be substantiated with the certified appraisal. And they will take a look at everything that you own. They'll take a look at the personal property. They'll take a look at any 401k or IRAs or Roth IRAs that are in your name, any stocks, business interests, commodities, life insurance that you own personally, any prepaid inputs, anything that's on your balance sheet that's in your name that you own at fair market value or appraised value. They will let you subtract Nebraska inheritance tax. They'll let you subtract any accounting fees, appraisal fees, probate expenses, attorney fees, any executor fees, and any debts that may be owed against the estate. But the value of that after those expenses is what the value of your estate is. And again, if you're over the exemption amount at that date, and for every dollar that you're over, you'll pay 40 cents on that dollar to the federal tax.
And how those assets are structured matters.
You can really have some aspects of how those assets are valued. So we can get a evaluation methodology done on some of these assets that will help save or reduce the true market value on some of those assets. Because today, the IRS allows what's called a lack of control or lack of marketability on certain assets. So I know a lot of you, if you pulled up a plat map or you looked on the assessor's website, a lot of people see LLCs, limited liability companies that own the farm ground, or they see family limited partnerships maybe listed or FLPs on the assessor's website or plat map. A reason we're using a lot of these for some of the real estate for our family farm or ranch operations is because we can actually go out and create non-voting shares inside that LLC. And we can give ownership to the next generation in the form of non-voting shares where they don't have control today, but they get a percentage of the ownership and maybe they get some income off that asset. But the major reason we do that is because we can at times take maybe up to a 30% discount on the value of those assets. And here's why. So if I throw our farm ground into an LLC and I give non-voting shares to my three daughters, let's say I give them 5% each. So my wife and I retain the voting shares and we own 85% of that LLC. At our death, who's going to come and buy 85% of that LLC at full market value and be in business with my three girls? Most of the time, you're not going to pay full market value for less than 100% control of the asset. And the IRS agrees with you. That's why they'll let you discount those assets as high as 30%, because nobody's going to pay full market value when they don't have 100% control. That's why they call it a lack of control or lack of marketability discount. So at times, if you're using one, two, three, four LLCs to own various real estate assets, and let's say those that real estate assets is worth $20 million. Well, if you take a 30% discount on $20 million, well, now those assets have a $6 million lack of marketability discount. Now they're only valued at $14 million. Well, at $14 million, you're not over the exemption. We just saved that operation $2.4 million in the federal estate tax. So how those assets are valued and the structure of that becomes very, very important when we talk about succession planning.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For the U.S. corn crop over this past week.
Not too surprising. No condition change for the U.S. corn crop.
Still rated same as last week at this time. 53% of the corn, good to excellent condition. 18% poor to very poor. And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says that's just about how the crop's going to end up.
The reason why we're not seeing much change is because at this point we have 82% of the crop fully mature on October 1st, well ahead of the five-year average of 75%.
And last season, 73%.
Meanwhile, the corn harvest advancing 8 points during the week to reach 23% nationally by October 1st. That is ahead of the five-year average of 21% and last year's 19%.
Corn harvest probably a little slower than you might expect, but
a lot of folks just leaving the corn out there. Conditions are ideal right now. It's quite dry.
Good conditions for dry down, saving a few dollars on propane. Gary Crawford, Washington.